What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast, episode 88, Non-Operative Treatment of Labral Tears in the Shoulder, featuring Dr. Stephen Flores. And again, we are recording live at the Memorial Hermann Sports Medicine Update. So we are very thankful for Bob Marley and the whole Memorial Hermann Sports Medicine team for allowing us to come out there. And my, again, special thanks to Dr. Josh Yellen and Dr. Mark Knobloch for doing pretty much all of the interviews. My former student, Jasmine Dozal, and current student, Sarah Avina, for all their work in helping record. So again, this is Non-Operative Treatment of Labral Tears in the Shoulder from Dr. Stephen Flores. Almost every week you can find us live on sportsmedicinebroadcast.com, or at least during the school year. During the summer we take breaks and try to take some time off. So again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. You can subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcast site there. And if there's any problems or if you have questions, comments, that's definitely what we're looking for. We really want some people to interact during the live show. Really want some people to ask questions or say, hey, this is something I would like to hear about. This is something I would like to get continuing education credits for. And that's something we're working towards currently. We were lacking in some areas on the for the BOC accreditation. And so we are currently in the process of getting that straightened out. So stick with us, as soon we'll be offering the BOC CEUs again.
Alright, so I think I'm good on caffeine. I'm probably bad on UC. So I need to go to BOC to get some of that. But unfortunately, we have no good Brian Christian videos, which are always a highlight of a whole type of them. But hopefully, this won't be as depressing as the first talk. but today, we're going to talk about disease and management of label injuries. And this is instability. This is superior label tears, slap tears. So we see this in throwers, swimmers, tennis players, obviously the football players, with the contact collision athletes, other guys that is probably a little more of an issue in terms of decision making. And we'll try to keep it mainly non-verbal because all of you guys obviously have probably heard talks like this more than once. But something hopefully that'll be useful for the treatment, when somebody gets hurt during the season and what really to do and when to refer and send out. So a little bit of background kind of on the field of court management, how we treat these initially, things that we need to consider and what we're really concerned about when we're making these as decision-making processes, either as trainers, therapists, or doctors, but also as the athlete, as the parents, because that young age group always comes with that caveat of when can he come back, does he need surgery, and whatnot. And then when they're able to return to play, kind of what things should be considered when it's a safe thing, and then when does surgery become a role, and if we have a little time, we'll run through just some stuff that I added just because I'm just going to leave that on the door. We're stuck on slides. Here we go. So when we're talking about these things, we can really break them up into several different things to really communicate to each other. So, whether it's an atraumatic or traumatic event, probably the first thing to consider. And then, obviously, which direction. So if it came out the front, if it came out the back, if it comes out down the bottom, it's pretty rare, but it does happen, or if it comes out in more than one place. And sometimes asking the athlete, especially the young athlete in the office, which direction did it come out, they usually can't tell you. Kind of my arm was here, and then it kind of went out and popped back in, or somebody came and pulled it back in. And that would be, full dislocation. The subluxations are the things that are hard, because that's very subjective. My arm felt like it wanted to come out. And maybe this is more of repetitive micro instability, from overuse and more of the overhead populations. And if this has become a first-time dislocation, so an acute event, it happened on Friday, you see him Saturday morning in clinic, as a doctor, if it's a recurrent, it's kind of happened, in the season several times, or this is a chronic, and it has been happening, I'm a senior, it's been going on since I was in seventh grade, and really all these things probably factor into our decision-making on whether or not somebody can return to play, probably when they can return to play, and whether or not they need to have a surgery, and if they do need to have a surgery, what kind of surgery can that be, and and really what the risks are of a reoccurrence. So the shoulder joint, obviously, you know, is probably one of the most injured joints in the body. I always say to people in the office when they're rehabbing these things, you know, my knee didn't take very long, I was better in 2 weeks. Well, the knee is kind of a down point. It goes back and forth. We don't know a lot about, you know, the ACL and different things. But really, if you can get extension back, if you get flexion back, if you're quad fire, then you're pretty much on the road to recovery. The shoulder is a very fine balance between multiple muscles, you know, rotator cuff, scapular muscles, and then all these other static stabilizers. So, you know, things that don't change, whether that's the labrum, whether that's ligaments or the capsule, or the shape of the bones, all these things really kind of come into play and are probably the reason why we have more injuries in this joint. You know, we kind of describe it as a golf ball sitting on a golf tee, and in the perfect, you know, environment, that ball is going to be completely balanced, and it takes a lot of things to get that to work. Now, if one of those things is off, then the ball falls off, and that's when the shoulder either comes out or subluxes or dislocates. Now, in the general population, not a very common injury. You know, usually it's going to take some sort of traumatic event, whether it's a fall or a car accident or something of that nature. And this more physically active population that you guys see, you know, when they're practicing, you know, 5 days a week, 6 days a week, they're playing games, they're playing scrimmages, these are when these injuries typically occur. And usually it's going to be in this contact collision sport, so football, hockey, which down here we don't see much of, but, you know, lacrosse is becoming a little more popular. You know, wrestling, all of these sports really are more the traumatic group, more a traumatic group. It's going to be more of that repetitive overhead, you know, swimmer, especially, you know, they swim 6 days, twice a day, 6 days a week, except on that seventh day when they only swim once a day. They never really give their body, you know, a break. Within this traumatic mechanism, the vast majority of them, again, either a fall or a forceful impact, this atraumatic, you know, is going to be really kind of repetitive micro subluxations to the point. And this is tough because a lot of this is subjective. My shoulder feels loose, or you know, they hurt, or they have pain. Why do they have pain? Get an MRI, MRI is normal. You know, exam is fairly normal. You know, they may be tilt a little bit loose, but you know, no different than the other side. These are the ones that are probably a little more difficult to treat, the ones that we really try not to operate on, unless they have just failed months and months and months of, you know, real rehab, doing the right thing. You ask them, oh, I've been doing rehab, what have you been doing? I've been doing some of these and some of these. But really have them structured, and that's really, you know, we rely on you guys, you know, doing your rehab programs, and they need to do a very good job of that. So treating these things, you know, the young patient, you know, we're probably going to be a little more conservative early on because, you know, we'll see here in a second, there's a very high incidence of recurrence, so 90 to 100% in some studies. So this patient, if we go back quickly, before they've done the appropriate, you know, recovery, are probably going to come out again. Now, somebody who's had this happen once before, they're probably going to be less painful. You know, the first time this event happens is usually when stuff tears. So that's when pain occurs. So they'll be less painful, they'll be less apprehensive. They've already come out once before. And so, you know, you start having conversations on, you know, what we need to do to either change this, maybe we're not playing, maybe we're considering surgery. But these are often a little bit quicker to recover. And then you have this more chronic instability on, you've all seen these guys and girls who, you know, come out once a game, pop back in, and they go back in the next series. And these are really going to be not a lot of pain, probably get back quicker, although the concern is if you end up in a surgery, the surgery may not be as simple as, you know, they were expecting, or as their buddy had, or their brother had, or sister had, and you may be having other discussions in the office. So what gets torn, you know, I say it's kind of like having a bungee cord on the back of the truck. You know, we'll focus on the labrum, which is, you know, one side. So if the labrum gets unhooked, well, everything falls out of the truck. But you can tear the middle, which is the capsule. You can tear off the ball, which is the attachment on the opposite side. Much less common injuries, but maybe, you know, unrecognized by us as physicians a little bit more, but getting a better understanding. Those probably need to be treated differently. And if you don't recognize where it's torn, maybe that's going to potentially not give you the appropriate surgery, the appropriate rehab. And And some of these, you know, atypical type injuries are probably more prone to re-injury or re-dislocation. So it is a factor in that decision-making process. And as we all know, you know, labrum, this is kind of cartilage, fibrous ring around the sacroiliac socket itself. It's the attachment site for the ligaments. It generates a suction effect and helps improve the congruency between the ball and the socket. You can see here, so, you know, on the top left, you know, the typical slap tear. These are all normal pictures, but that repetitive overhead activity with the biceps eventually pull and then grower to get this peel back, you know, back here, and that will push your posterior labrum. On the bottom left, you will be more posterior instability, and the front is that typical anterior dislocation where this thing detaches. But not as simple as just a modifying the label here. Just have a label that doesn't need to be the vascular problem. The capsule is kind of that structure in between. Some people very few consider a kind of sphere in the ball. There's more space for the ball to move around. Well, maybe that person is going to have a little more motion, which is good in an overhead thrower. But bad in a contact collision athlete. The glenohumeral ligaments are these thickenings of the capsule itself, and these things tighten. So they tighten in the end range of the motion. So depending upon the degree of instability or the degree of direction, if you're up in this top position or abducted externally rotated position, that's typically where the ball is going to come out the front. This kind of cross arm, forward flex, internally rotated position. It's going to be, you know, things coming out the back. This is just somebody who had a very loose shoulder, obviously had a significant anterior instability with, you know, component changes. So these ligaments, again, the one to focus on would be, you know, this bottom anterior glenohumeral ligament. And there's two bands. We don't really get into much of that today, but just know, you know, the anterior is tight in adduction external location, the posterior tight in flexion internal location. These are things just to consider rehabbing. And trying to avoid that provocative position early on in a recovery, and whether or not you're bracing somebody, you know, you want to limit those directions easier in some sports, harder than others. Now, obviously, this can come out the back, probably less common. Come out the front, probably the most common, and then out the bottom, which is fairly atypical, probably a little bit harder to reduce, but that's probably going to be more in a high, you know, energy car accident, you know, fall from a significant height. The top two are the ones really we're going to focus on today. So anterior instability, you know, the vast majority, you know, up to, you know, 95% of all dislocations occur this way. This is when we typically see, usually either a force up in this abducted rotated position. Occasionally, you know, a blow from behind can cause it to happen. Pretty rare, and somebody asks about it, no, it's hit from behind. Like, really? And that ball is able to just be forced out if they, you know, get a helmet or get an arm or a head, you know, right in that appropriate position when they're in that provocative position. And again, avoiding that early provocative direction would be key in this early rehab. We have to have the, I guess, requisite Matt Shaw picture today. So Matt had a posterior dislocation. This is, you know, much less common. Usually it's a fall. With your arm braced out, someone landing on you from behind is how most of the traumatic ones occur. Offensive linemen, the repetitive, you know, punching that they do when they're blocking. A lot of those guys are on posterior labral tears, and we see that every year at the NFL combines. And a lot of those guys have posterior labral tears, never had surgery, and they're stable on exam. They have no symptoms, but it's just kind of something that, you know, you're a little leery of, that might be an issue, you know, down the road. Classically, I think the test answer is usually seizure or electrical shock, and the muscles contract, and so there's much more muscles in the back than the front, and so those muscles contract and rip the ball out the back part, and those are often associated with fractures. And then repetitive overhead athletes may be more prone to this because that capsule is a lot more thinner in the back. When you're fixing these things and repairing these things, we notice the difference between the two tissue qualities, and so that's just more prone to stretching. Multi-directional, again, typically we think of this as a young, thin, red-headed female, and the shoulder just kind of goes loosey-goosey. But, you know, studies show that really men and women have about equal incidence. It really just means direction or instability more than one direction. Usually younger people, as you age, tend to stop dislocating, which is, you know, and everybody in this room probably have an episode of instability. Usually you don't need surgery, unless it just keeps happening, or it's painful, or even you can do the things that you want to do. And there's, some scales to look at to kind of assess whether or not someone's lax, the whole double jointed type appearance, or significant elbow and knee hyperextension. Putting your palms down to the floor, if you have a certain number, maybe that identifies you as someone who's lax, and that might change how you treat somebody, probably more from a surgical standpoint than a real rehab standpoint. But if you do operate on these people, if you have somebody like this, and rehab and muscular activation and strengthening is really going to be the key to everything. So all of you guys already know all this stuff, so really on-field management, obviously you want to figure out, A, do they have an injury? A lot of times the young kid's going to be a little hysterical and can't calm down, but if you saw the injury, if you saw the mechanism, like everything else, kind of quickly, what's going on. If they had a prior history, obviously if they've dislocated, a week before or a month before, you probably figure it's common things being common, it's probably the same thing. If you can get the individual to calm down and you can examine them, they will give you kind of the clue. And then really you want to kind of get this thing back in as quickly as possible. Ideally, depending upon the sport and the condition, whether it's a game or practice or there's people around, if you get it in on the field, that's ideal. I think if it happened in a basketball and an NBA arena, they're going into the back. We're not going to do that, right there on the court itself. If you're unsuccessful, obviously a transfer to the emergency room, because at that time the muscles are probably spasms. And they're probably going to need some sort of sedation. But if you can get them early, as everybody knows, they're a lot easier to come back in. If they've come out multiple times, they're probably going to be a lot easier to come back in. Ones out the back, probably a little more difficult. Then, getting an exam to look at nerve function and motor exam is probably very useful as an axillary nerve, so deltoid compensation with fairly high incidence of at least either a neuropraxia or nerve kind of contusion bruise. But I have seen people who actually have complete nerve injuries from this. I think there's a talk either later today or tomorrow on just on reduction techniques, which I think Dr. Kidding will probably go over this a little more in detail. But typically, simple traction, if you can stabilize somebody and it's early on, you can pull it back in. The traction, counter traction, if you have the assistance of somebody else and you're in a an environment where this is you're able to do this, that can be very helpful. Probably is what you see in an emergency room more often. They tie a sheet around somebody and you start gaining, but you can get to them early, typical just simple traction and a little rotation to get the ball back in. Some of these other techniques can be useful, especially laying prone. You don't have access to a weight, and a lot of people don't, especially at a game or an event. Simple, longitudinal traction and a little massage and get somebody to kind of calm down. And once those muscles fatigue, then the ball kind of pop back in. I've done this, on guys who dislocated go to the center during practice, and then they, for some reason, drive them up to the medical center to have them sit back in, and you can get them to relax and just put it in this way fairly easily, even after they've already spasmed. Posterior instability, again, probably a little less common. Again, same principles. Again, traction to kind of disengage the ball from the glenoid and really trying to make sure that the ball is all the way disengaged and then a gentle rotation as it slides back into place. Again, this one may be a little more difficult to get in, may require, sedation. But prior, probably a higher incidence of fracture. But a lot of people kind of just come back in. These are the ones that often are missed. So if you have a kid who, they go to the emergency room and the doctor says they're fine, but you're like, something's wrong, they need to go somewhere else. Because I've seen several of these who have come in, and they were actually missed in the ER. One guy actually was missed in 2 ERs. Even after he told somebody, first doctor called, said it's out, the second doctor said, no, you're fine. After the game, examine for other injuries, depending upon whether they have pads on, if they don't have pads on, this could be easier to be done at the same time. Typical sling, ice, and stem, just kind of pain, and then setting up some of a follow-up, and know, Walt kind of gave a good talk early. It's all about, you know, communicating with everybody to make the appropriate decisions. And at minimum, x-rays need to be done. Whether or not everybody needs an MRI or if they need a CT scan, I think is a little debatable. I think it's a conversation for, you know, us to have with, you know, family and the individuals themselves, and what the role is of that, whether or not it's going to change anything, because, you know, I think ordering $1,000 tests on people, there's not going to be any change for whatever problem it is, it's probably a little irresponsible on our part. So traditionally, you know, sleep for a few weeks, and then, you know, physical therapy, return to activity, but really sleep duration hasn't really been shown to be beneficial. We'll talk about, you know, that is controversial still today. Something just came across my phone last week on a new external rotation bracing study, and whether or not there's a role of this, and then whether or not early return to sports is advisable or realistic. So this external rotation kind of concept is, if you kind of keep the arm out to the side, you'll buttress that labrum back up to the socket. And there's some good basic science cadaver stuff, but as you know, we all know, not everything translates from a cadaver into a real-life human. There's some MRI studies that kind of show this, and there's some other, you know, studies that kind of have looked at this. You know, these two books came out, you know, about 7 years ago now, when this thing first became popular. At the same time, one study showed 50% reduction, one study showed really no decrease. So, hard to really say, but it's essentially, you know, this extra, you know, pad that goes on to the side of a traditional, you know, sling here, the buttress up, just labrum as opposed to being in that, you know, typical internally rotated, simple, you know, sling that we get at, you know, CVS or Walgreens. Another study came out that really showed no difference with the 2009, 37% versus 42%. And these were young patients, so this is our, you know, 20-year-old population, traumatic non-car accident. This one that just came out, I think, last week, looked at, you know, 102 patients, but again, older age population. So I think age is something to really consider when we're talking about shoulder injuries and how we should treat it. It's not a quick book, you're not going to treat everybody the same, everybody's going to be a little bit different. And they showed really, you know, a huge difference, 33 versus, you know, 4%. Although, you know, kind of compliance with wearing this brace was discontinued mobilization. 20% of people in this external group said, I'm not going to wear this thing, this is stupid. And only 6% in the simple group. So, again, somebody who's young probably is going to be more compliant, we all know that. And, you know, maybe this isn't something that's realistic to think someone's going to wear. But if somebody asks you, if a parent asks you, we don't want surgery, we're willing to give us time to heal, what can we do to potentially decrease our risk? Well, this is something that we could say potentially might help, but there's no guarantee. So, you know, again, I think the first talk this morning really kind of emphasized, you know, the whole inform consent and signing a piece of paper doesn't hold up in a court of law, but, you know, talking to people, you know, appropriate documentation, I think is, you know, useful. But really, you know, the best thing for the athlete, for the patient, is really kind of our job to really emphasize and telling them what their risks are. You know, what could happen if we continue to play. And as trainers and coaches and therapists and physicians, I think all, everybody working together in the ideal situation, this makes everyone's life a lot easier. Individualizing the athlete, you know, depending upon, you know, the sport, the position, you know, everybody's got different tolerances for pain, tolerances for discomfort, you know, positional, they're throwing. This is going to be harder to come back from. If you're running back, this is probably not going to be the hardest to come back from. And you can raise certain positions for sure, but you can't raise other ones.
If you have to limit
kind of individualizing athletes to the appropriate treatment, I think is, you know, very useful. And again, not cookbook, you know, you got to progress through goals, A to C, don't skip B, and we're doing this. You know, there's some basic early healing, there's no magic pill, no magic cream that we can get this thing to heal faster, you know, whether or not it's surgery or whether or not it's not surgical. So most of these here early on, you take no surgery, first time dislocator, but you need to allow tissues to heal, you need to allow pain to improve. Potential role for injections, I think, again, in that pro sport, you know, PRP, bone marrow injected into a joint, people seem to feel a difference. I don't think anybody knows why, but it seems to work. And in that setting, again, there's probably not a lot of harm done, a lot of harm. about what that cost is. I think, unfortunately, does play a role in some of these decision-making processes. And then once, you know, they're pain-free, we can strengthen, we need that dynamic control of the muscles that help keep the ball centered. And again, if you have a more significant injury, maybe you're going to be a little less aggressive. Focusing on dynamic strength, though, cuff, periscapular muscles is really kind of the basis for all this. Again, obviously, overhead, athletes probably going to take a little bit longer. This is really where we kind of rely on you guys, because we just speculate on rotator cuff strengthening, scapular stabilization, and kind of cross our fingers and hope that everything, you know, is done right, because we probably couldn't give you a list of exercises and tell you really what to do. But it all starts at the scapula. You know, it's kind of forms the base for the socket to kind of put the socket at the appropriate position when the ball is moving. So think of the scapula at the base, the ball is kind of this moving part, and the muscles are kind of driving the ball into that socket. And so, you know, lower trap, upper trap, serratus, scapular retraction, posture is a huge deal, you know, and especially in young kids, especially kids with shoulder pain, they all have bad posture, and you tell them, you know, like, parents love you when you need to sit up straight and really hold it back. The kind of the basis. And then as you kind of progress, you know, into some more higher level, you know, rhythmic stabilization, close chain exercises, plyo ball type stuff. These are all things as you advance and someone's able to accomplish, you know, the early stages, we can kind of go from level to level. Rotator cuff, again, is going to be a steering mechanism, and again, it's kind of like a pulley. If one pulley's off on one side, then everything kind of falls down. So really kind of getting the muscles pretty coordinated, and even after surgeries, my shoulder kind of feels like it wants to, you know, pop and catch, and that's really kind of a muscle issue more than anything else. I mean, getting this compression early on, whether or not it's just a simple isometric and getting cuff firing is very useful. Once, you know, motions progress and we can do, you know, some light strengthening, again, a scapular plane motion, you know, fairly easy, you know, progressive TheraBand, which, you know, everybody has access to, you know, they don't need to be lifting heavy weights, and some kids think for some reason they need to be, you know, bench pressing early on, and probably the worst thing that they can do. And so once you've kind of done early strengthening, isometrics, and scapular exercises, you go to, you know, more progressive type TheraBand exercises, and then eventually, you know, the more sport-specific type activity, whether or not that's a throwing program for a pitcher, whether or not that's more punching drills, blocking drills for linemen. Once they're able to pass through all these kind of rehab milestones, that they can return kind of to play. So returning to play, obviously, you'd like to have them full motion. I mean, it may not be 100% versus the other side. Again, depending upon the sport, that's probably acceptable or not acceptable. Depending on the position, that's acceptable or not acceptable. A receiver is not going to be able to play with a harness on his shoulder to catch the ball. And a quarterback can't do that on his throwing shoulder. A soccer goalie can't do that. But a lineman can. So you like to have, you know, good motion. You like to have most of their strength with a fairly good balance in between the two. And again, these are probably very subjective. Not everyone's going to get on that. On a Cybex and, you know, test these things out, but, you know, functional strength to be able to do the things that they need to do for their particular sport. And then, you know, not be apprehensive and mentally be ready to go back. Now, how do we do with these things? Probably not very good with young people. So, again, very, very high recurrence rate. Again, as you age, it becomes less of an issue. Again, this young group that we're treating, you know, you have to tell them if you have a high incidence that is coming out, and if we're not, and if it comes out throughout the year, we really need to make a decision at the end of the year to fix it if there's time to fix it. The problem is they finish playing, they don't do anything, hey, I'm good, they go to spring practice, first week they dislocate again, and now kind of we're up against the wall in terms of timing. If you say it's 5 or 6 months to come back from a surgery, you know, that now we start biting into, you know, summer practice, August, and the season again. The recurrence rates, again, busy slide, don't look at anything but the stuff in the yellow. So really, younger people, boys, contact collision sports. So football, lacrosse, hockey, wrestling, those type of activities are probably going to be our biggest risk factors.
this point.
And it's really directly linked to how much damage he's done. So if it's bad injury, if it's bad bone injury, the top one's just kind of a soft tissue injury, kind of a ripped off good quality tissue, the bottom
it's
more of a top, more of a bony injury, so you don't even see labor kind of hiding down there on the bottom. And so the work, obviously, common sense, the worse it was, the worse the injury was, the more likely it's going to happen again. So if there's a high recurrence rate, if people don't do well when they dislocate, and maybe or maybe not, there are a lot of issues later down the line, if you operate on them early, you know, that's I mean, still debatable up to this kind of thing. Some people will say, you know, there's a cost standpoint when operating on the first time dislocator, actually a cost
saving. People are going to want to miss season if they dislocate early. And I think he thought I was just tweeting because I'm a teenager. And I felt really bad before I turned it off.
Who knows if we're we do a lot on Twitter. Yeah, so he said, hey, what's the Twitter handle? So,
And again, you want to consider position, sport, hand dominance. If it's a thrower, a right-handed thrower, and they do the left arm, they're probably not going to have an issue. The right arm, well, that probably needs to be fixed. So if you operate on everybody, you're probably going to fix people who don't need surgery. The recurrence rate's high, but it's not 100%. And this young age group, especially that contact collision age group, you're probably really going to recommend this, unless there's going to not be support anymore. Surgically, we'll just kind of breeze through this real fast. You know, arthroscopic, I think that's kind of, you know, what most people do these days, right or wrong. I think it's how most guys are trained. People seem to get better too fast from this, and that's something I think that us as physicians and therapists and trainers really need to hold that young group back. Because you want them right. They're going to get motion back. And so whether or not, you know, fracture recovery is good or bad, I think is very debatable. The benefit of the meniscope is you can see everything. I think the old open procedures, you know, you see a lot of these people who've had surgery done, they get an MRI, whether or not it's, you know, basketball or football players or the combines, you know, will have a posterior label tear, but they have the anterior one fixed, and it was an open. Well, they just couldn't see the back. But it allows us to do more work. It allows, you know, less pain, probably less stiffness, and address other issues. And really, the results are about the same, you know, especially in today's modern, you know, age of arthroscopy and implants. Now, large bony defects, again, this is that recurrent dislocator. You know, these are the ones that don't do well with school procedures. And unfortunately, I think, you know, the vast majority of guys are going to do a scope, you know, 99 times out of 100 and not address this. And this is when we start talking about getting CT scans and considering other options, because a simple, cost-efficient procedure that we usually do isn't really going to work. So, you know, significant bone loss. If you think of the socket as more of a circle, you know, you're missing the full bottom quadrant. Of bone. They say it's this inverted pair, so think of a pair, and you know, we're missing, you know, 20-25%. Well, that golf ball and golf tee now isn't gonna work. So that's just gonna fall off, and they can try to just tighten the tissue back up, especially someone who's been with back through activity. This is not gonna do very well. So what concerns us, you know, I've been dislocating for 4 years, I dislocate at nighttime, minimal trauma causes this to come out. You know, from an exam standpoint, you know, discomfort at very, very low levels of abduction. So they don't have to be up here to dislocate. They kind of don't like you when you're just out to the side and you start to rotate. This is when something different has to be done. And you start talking about these bony augmentation procedures and probably, you know, much more common in Europe, but I think over the last 5, you know, years, this has really become more acknowledged here in the U.S. Having these done. Earlier return to play, it's debatable. I think the French let you go pretty much from day one and say, hey, you can do whatever you want to do. But, you know, I think a young American, especially, you know, male, has so much muscle mass. You see a lot of these things just ripped apart. And every year in Indianapolis, they say, you know, the guys have had them done, and I would say, you know, 4 out of 5, you know, screws pulled out, bones pulled off. People are still very stable for whatever reason. But I think you still have to go fairly slow on these things to allow that bone to heal. But it's basically a fracture. You were creating a fracture. And these do really, really well and we have the appropriate indication, but it's probably a salvage procedure. It's probably not something to do, you know, the first time out. But if this doesn't work, then there's problems. There's not really a good second option. So just to conclude, traumatic, shoulder instability results from injuries to the labrum, the capsule, ligaments.
What you guys are doing?
The vast majority of these things don't need surgery, at least the first time. The question is, and I don't think anybody has an answer for you, is that, gum contact collision sport, dislocated once, has no further issues all year, whether or not that person needs surgery. I think half of those come back, half of them don't. But I would say if they haven't had recurrent issues, if you're probably fine, it's kind of like patellar instability. If you come out one time, that's a 15% chance of it happening again, and it comes out twice, well, now it's a 50% chance. So you start having those conversations with, kids and parents and coaches about all of this. Again, that high-risk collision or contact type sport, surgery, they probably all work done correctly. To say one's better than the other is probably a lie. I think whatever is best in your physician's hands is appropriate, with the exception of, open surgery needed for these bone injuries. And then, I don't know if this came out, there's a couple of his rehab guidelines that I pulled from a pretty good paper for just anterior and posterior instability. So, if they didn't come out well, I can get into Bob and you can put them on.
All right, I'm Dr. Josh Yellen, Program Director for the Master of Athletic Training Program at the University of Houston. Find us at www.hhp.uh.edu/MAT, like Master of Athletic Training Program. We're fortunate enough here to be sitting with Dr. Steve Flores. Dr. Flores, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about you. I was reading in your bio that you came from Texas A&M, and I believe Jasmine is a second-year student, going on a third-year student in kinesiology at A&M. We were just wondering, what does GIGM mean?
I have no idea.
But we just know it is.
But we just know what it is, and we say it. and howdy, and I think we wear boots, and drive pickup trucks.
Okay, got it. And are you from that area of Texas?
I am not. I'm from San Antonio, actually.
San Antonio, Texas. All right, so you went to Texas A&M, and then you went to the Baylor College of Medicine, is that right?
That's correct, yes.
And then you got out in what year?
I graduated medical school, and I always have to think about this, in 2001.
And then you went on for your orthopedic residency.
Correct, in Chicago.
In Chicago. Where did you do that?
Northwestern, yes.
And then you did your internship and residency there?
Correct.
And then you did a fellowship where?
Back at the Baylor Sports Medicine Program in 2006.
And then you got picked up with UT Physicians Ironman Sports Medicine Institute in what year?
I graduated fellowship in 2007. My first 2 years, I think I spent actually still at Baylor with Walt Lowe, and then in 2009, transitioned over to UT and the Sports Medicine Institute.
Walter Lowe was just here, and he talked about some of the things that he, in his lecture, and some of the advancements of being a team physician, etc. Tell us, your real specialty is in the shoulder. Shoulder's super, super complicated, right? All these different ranges of motion, and we know that, the glenohumeral joint is like sitting, what's the analogy they give? It's like a golf ball sitting on a golf tee.
Yeah, that's usually something that people can grasp their hands around and really kind of conceptualize it a little bit better. And if that tee is really not centered correctly, well, then the ball falls off. And there's a lot of different things that have to work in play. And I say that the knee's a dumb joint, no offense to Dr. Lowe. And the shoulder's a little more complicated. Takes a little more work to kind of do what we need to happen.
Yeah, right. The knee goes through flexion, extension, slight medial rotation, slight lateral rotation, slight valgus stress, and slight varus stress. And then we get into glenohumeral joint, right? Let's break up. If I go back to my anatomy, I was always taught there's a difference between the glenohumeral joint and then the shoulder complex. That glenohumeral joint is really the golf ball and the golf tee.
Correct.
And then the shoulder is really that scapulothoracic joint, the acromioclavicular joint, the sternoclavicular joint, and all that moves, right? For every 2 degrees of motion, I think linear humeral joint 1 degree at scapula thoracic. Is that right?
That's perfect. You get the test answer right.
That's it.
Yes.
That's
A,
it.
A plus.
I can go be an orthopedic surgeon.
Yeah, you're ready.
Okay,
we'll
good.
Give you a knife and you can go.
Oh, perfect. Good. Hey, speaking of knives, you know, one of the affiliations I made with the program is that we have affiliated with our College of Optometry, and so we have three fresh cadavers in their extremities. What about you coming over one day and showing us some of your work? Do you think you can do that?
Figure out a time.
All right.
There we go.
So tell us a little bit more about the shoulder. How did you get interested in the shoulder? And tell us some of the advancements that you're doing over there at UT Health Center.
You know, I think it really just kind of boils down. When you talk about sports medicine, you know, the typical injuries are going to occur in a knee and a shoulder. I do both of them, but, you know, shoulder's kind of one of those things where there's more injuries. And so therefore probably more opportunity, and it's really been something that I think I've had the opportunity to really see a lot of and treat. And again, this is not just young people, this is, you know, every people of all ages, your mom, your dad, your grandma, your grandpa, your brother, your sister, your next door neighbor, and people have injuries, and a lot of these, you know, don't need surgery, and unfortunately a lot of people get surgeries that they don't need to have done. And a lot of these can be treated with, you know, rehab. Probably the vast majority of them can. There's a small subset that, you know, really needs surgery, and some of the, you know, more arthroscopic or, you know, little camera with small incisions around the shoulder joint, those are kind of in some of the benefits and advances in the surgeries, in addition to probably some of the biologic stuff that you guys talked about earlier, I'm sure, with Walt. Those are kind of some things that we're really seeing as helping people. Whether or not, you know, things will change in the future, I'm sure they will. Everything always does. But I think, you know, as we gain more knowledge in each joint, we're able to better treat people and get better function and better results.
Tell us a little bit about your philosophy of surgery, right? I was always taught that when you have an injury, let's try to use some conservative treatment, you know, pat down those chemical mediators a little bit. And I have a question for you about chemical mediators and some medicines and some of your experience, but let's see if we can really treat it with ice and anti-inflammatories, and then let's see if we can rehab it. If we can't rehab it, let's try to medicate it. If we can't medicate it, let's go scope it. If we can't scope it, let's go cut it.
Yeah. Right? You know, I'm a big believer in not burning bridges. You know, and unfortunately, if you do surgery right away, well, that you're on the other side of the bridge, and the bridge is, you know, pretty much burned. So, you know, again, the vast majority of things can be treated, you know, with time. Time's a great healer. You know, I think we've all had shoulder injury. I woke up, my shoulder's sore. I had a heavy, you know, workout yesterday, and it's just kind of been bothering me. Well, most of the time it goes away. And if it doesn't, well, that's, you know, when you go see your doctor. And then at that point, you know, maybe some medication, maybe, you know, some exercises, maybe, you know, not doing, you know, certain things will really help you. Then at some point, if that all that fails, and you have, you know, a complaint that is consistent with, you know, your exam, which is consistent with an MRI, well, it's reasonable to think that a surgery is going to help you. Now, those don't match up. It's a little more difficult, and it's probably not realistic to think that, you know, operating on, you know, this little tear that's on the MRI is really going to help you if they really don't have anything to do with each other. So, you know, I think most people don't want surgery. And
why do you think that is?
It's scary. Yeah, scared. I think, you know, you're gonna go to sleep. Am I gonna wake back up? Am I gonna get an infection? Am I gonna be better? Am I gonna be able to do the things that I did before? There's a big unknown, and unless you've had it before, and the people who have are usually, as long as they've had a good result, they're usually much more willing to go back again. If they had a bad result, you know, they're not gonna want to do it, or you're gonna have to twist some arms. If they've never had it done, well, you know, there's definitely, you know, you have to mentally grasp these things. And I think that's the hard thing for young people is, you know, the unknown. We don't like the unknown.
So, you know, one of the things that Dr. Lowe brought up was this mental preparedness of how to return from an ACL. Do you have a mental preparedness of how to return from a shoulder injury?
You know, I think it's all basically the same. I think, you know, mentally you need to, you know, not be scared. Because when you're scared and you kind of, you know, try to limit yourself, that's typically when injuries get hurt, which is why, you know, I think going in, you'd say, okay, mentally I'm ready for surgery. And then afterwards, you have to be mentally ready to rehab. And if you're depressed and you're unhappy and the world has ended, you're not going to do what you need to do. You're not going to get off pain pills. You're not going to be able to return back to play. And once you can, you know, then that's when you see good results. And some people, day one, they're good to go. Mm-hmm. And other people, it takes time. And not everybody's the same.
So one of the things we learned in school, I remember both in undergraduate and graduate school, you know, I learned about this Kubler-Ross five stages of death as it relates to an injury, right? Anger, denial, depression, bargaining, acceptance. Is that something that you follow in your office, or do you have your own scale that you follow? You kind of go based off your clinical expertise?
Yeah, I think it goes based upon, you know, just kind of getting to know somebody. And the more you know them, again, I think it's difficult to assign recipes to people. And I like to tell people, you know, it's not you're not baking a cake. It's not the same for everybody. And you may be a little bit different than, you know, somebody else, your brother, your sister, you know. And so I think just kind of gauging a sense of where somebody is, and that's difficult. You know, I wouldn't say that we're all, you know, great at that, especially as orthopedic surgeons. It's really probably, unfortunately, something that we don't get taught. But I think, you know, when you have that person and you have those issues, I think there's, you know, definitely the healthcare professionals that, you know, have an expertise in that. And sometimes you have to say, hey, this is beyond me. I need you to go see somebody to get right.
So it really sounds like you really value a relationship with your patient. You want to get to know who they are as an individual and who they are as a person, so that you guys can go through this experience together.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think as physicians, we all should at least, we want our patients to get better. You don't want them to come back and be unhappy. And unfortunately, that's not 100%. You know, you can't bat 1,000, you know, but batting, you know, 333, you know, you go to the Hall of Fame, but you're a bad doctor if you do that.
Right.
So, you know, you would like for the vast majority of guys to be happy. And I think really, you know, the more personal interaction you have with them, they're going to be happier with you because they think you care, and they have to trust you. I think there's a big trust issue here. So I always say, help me help you. I can help you, but you have to want to be helped.
Yeah. So going back to the shoulder, it's, you know, the topic that you were talking about, tell us just a little bit about some of these various injuries. So let's give you a scenario. I have a patient that falls on an outstretched hand, foosh is what we call it, and you know, there's some sort of posterior translation, the glenohumeral joint, possible posterior labrum, possible supraspinatus, that kind of stuff. Walk us through a case scenario like that and some of the steps that you would take.
So I think, you know, when you think about, you know, injuries, a lot of those can be based upon, you know, age. So at what age do people get typical injuries? So young people typically don't have rotators up here. Old people.
Why is that?
Because the tendon is much stronger and it takes a lot of force to tear that.
And so that's consistent for all four rotator cuff muscles?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, again, there's partial tears. Sure. And there's, I mean, you see them, but it's, you know, common things being common, it's not the most common thing. And so, you know, somebody falls on the outstretched arm, they feel their shoulders kind of shift a little bit. Obviously, be concerned about, you know, a little labral injury, posterior labrum.
Yeah, what kind of labral injury are you going to be concerned about?
I'd be concerned about a posterior labral tear.
And is there a name for that?
Posterior labral tear, depending upon where it is. I mean, you could call it a Bankart tear,
right, right.
Depending upon, you know, where it is. A Bankart, it was Dr. Bankart, is somebody who got something named after them. And it just depends. It's classically more in the front part of the shoulder, although, you know, we're orthopedic surgeons, we're not really smart, so we just kind of add anterior and posterior, and keep one name associated with both of them. But you'd be concerned about a posterior labral tear, which the vast majority, you know, can be rehabbed and do well. On the people who have continued issues, and that's typically, you know, depending upon the sport, can affect them, or, you know, in the weight room, trying to bench press, trying to lift, a lot of those guys will complain of pain in the back of their shoulder, because if you just imagine that ball kind of going back, it's going to maybe move a little extra, but maybe not have the same degree of instability as you would if you came out the front. There's a lot more muscle in the back to help keep you in place.
Right, and so talk about the instability, you know, when that ball, that the head of the humerus slides back in that glenoid fossa. Tell us a little bit about posterior impingement, and then tell us a little bit about the, you know, the what do they call it? The sick scapula or something like that, where, you know.
Yeah. So post your impingement, again, typically more in overhead athletes, you know, it's typically the kind of compression or when the ball of the head hits the posterior superior labrum, so the part that's right behind the biceps tendon, and that kind of hits the rotator cuff. So you see this, if you imagine, you know, some of these, you know, pitchers or tennis players who get in this real cocked position with their arms like kind of facing the wrong direction, like they've dislocated, but that's just their motion that allows them to generate velocity. Now, if you have, you know, not very good muscular control or maybe some tightness in part of the shoulder joint, that ball may kind of ride up and cause that posterior impingement. Mm-hmm. Again, usually something that doesn't need surgery until you get to the point of no return when things start to tear, and then you kind of lose your window maybe to rehab these things. Sick scapula is basically a condition where the scapula itself has non-coordinated or asynchronous motion. Mm-hmm. And so if you think of the T, again, we go back to our ball and T concept, golf T concept. The T is kind of the most lateral or outside part of the scapula, and that serves the base for the ball to sit. Now, the muscles aren't working, they're not being coordinated, that base, that platform's not going to be in the right spot for that ball, mm-hmm. and so that ball's going to move up, down, sideways, just not in the right direction, and you start having issues, typically with pain. More than anything else, it's a non-surgical issue.
Right.
It's a rehab issue to get, you know, muscle strength and you know, very, very, very smart people have kind of looked at this, and it's very difficult probably to allow people to grasp and say, you need to get stronger. It's like, I am strong. You know, I can bench press. Wrong kind of strong.
Right. Your scapula's just not moving. It's not retracting, protracting,
correct, yeah.
and elevating and depressing the way it needs to. So that leads us into another question, two questions for you. Let's transition from posterior issues of the shoulder to anterior issues of the shoulder. I have a middle linebacker, goes for a tackle, outstretched arm, abducted, externally rotated, that glenohumeral joint, you know, that head slides right through that foramen of Weitbrecht. Wow.
Sounds smart.
That's a big one. Foramen of Weitbrecht, right? So you've now dislocated your glenohumeral joint. You reduced the joint on the field. Tell us a little bit about from the time of injury to the time of return to play to the time of rehab, and how do you know when you need to do surgery and when not?
So, you know, again, going back to our cookbook, very different for different guys, you know, probably very different for positions. Some guys, you know, are able to progress pretty quickly, and as a lineman, you know, when your main job is blocking out in front of you, you know, this may be a little bit easier than if you were the quarterback and this was your right arm and you were having to throw. And so, you know, typically you can, obviously, number one, get pain kind of control, get rotator cuff, get muscles firing, at least with some basic exercises, progress motion, avoid that, you know, provocative position, which is how they came out in the first place. And then once they're able to have, you know, fairly good motion, good strength, you may allow them to progress back to play. And that could be, you know, 2, 3, 4 weeks. And oftentimes you probably put them in some sort of harness or brace to keep them from, you know, kind of going in that extreme in range of motion. Mm-hmm. Guys who can't progress through that, or if they've had multiple injuries, you have the surgery conversation, but that's typically a off-season conversation for most people, unless there was a significant bony component fracture, or again, one of these weird rotator cuff tears that occasionally will occur at the time of an injury.
So somebody dislocates their shoulder, the glenohumeral joint slides right through that weakness in the anterior joint. What kind of labral tear is going to be associated with that?
So that's going to be an anterior, inferior, that Bankart tear,
right,
that we usually see.
So again, we've got, for all those that are listening and learning something from Dr. Flores here, we've got two types of Bankart lesions. One is that posterior and then the anterior inferior. And those anterior inferior dislocations are the more common than the posterior.
Correct, yeah, probably 90% of instability episodes are anterior.
And so let's talk about that acute injury, right? There's some debate right now in the sports medicine field about, you know, to ice, not to ice. Let's talk about the difference between some analgesics versus anti-inflammatories. Everybody seems to have a different opinion. You know, one of the things that I was asked is, you know, what do I think about ice? Well, if I look at it from a rehab standpoint, ice is an infrared modality. Technically, it only penetrates 1 centimeter, but it's moving at a slower wavelength, and we know that it can change that perception of you know, pain, spasm, pain, using the gait control theory, afferent pathways, etc. And then they talk a little bit about anti-inflammatories versus analgesics. What's your standpoint from a surgeon? What is it that you want to see? Because ultimately, if there's an injury, right, you and I are going to, you know, talk to each other, and you're going to say, hey, listen, this is what I want to see, and have, you know, send them back, and I'm going to contact you back and say, this is what we're seeing. So tell us a little bit about your philosophy and what it is that you think is best.
You know, the big question on, you know, that stuff, and I don't know if there's a really a right or wrong answer. If you really look at things probably from a scientific, you know, basic science standpoint, you know, the first phase of healing is inflammation. So you want blood driving to an area to have these, you know, new cells kind of lay down, you know, chemical neurotransmitters and whatnot. And so when you think about it, well, why would I ice and inhibit that process? Why would I take anti-inflammatories and inhibit that process? Well, you know, I think, why shouldn't I heat it and actually get more blood flow? But, you know, I think you're looking at pain here more than anything else, and really you probably want to, you know, minimize pain so you can allow, you know, progressive, you know, function. So, you know, whether or not there's a right or wrong, I think is very debatable. You know, analgesics, Tylenol, acetaminophen, you know, pain pills, for whatnot. I think, you know, most of us try to avoid that stuff. Most people don't need that stuff. Mm-hmm. Anti-inflammatories, you know, Advil, Aleve, ibuprofen, again, can help with, you know, pain. And again, it's torn. It's not going to heal, unfortunately. And so whether or not you're really changing anything, I think it's debatable. What you're trying to decrease is, you know, the inflammatory cascade, the synovitis within the shoulder joint, and which is why sometimes these, you know, other things that we inject, you know, whether or not it's, you know, PRP or bone marrow or some of the stuff y'all probably talked about earlier, you know, sometimes seem to have an effect, but we don't really know the direct pathways on why. But it seems to be beneficial for decreasing inflammation and helping healing.
Okay. So a couple more questions if you have the time.
Sure.
You got to be in the operating room today?
Got patients waiting.
Okay. So let's just wrap this up. Let's give you one more question here. Bill, you got a question for Dr. Flores?
No, I'm just enjoying this conversation.
Jasmine, do you have a question for Dr. Flores? Okay, then I'll ask one last question here. You know, looking at going back to the difference between shoulder and knee, and looking at all the other aspects of sports medicine, if you were going to give some advice to some people that are just getting into that sports medicine field, right? You've been around for a while. Bill's been around for a while. I've been around for a while. What's some of your advice? Why did you choose sports medicine over some other areas of orthopedics? And why did you choose orthopedics over some other areas of medicine?
I think the benefit of orthopedics is I think you get the opportunity to fix things. You know, somebody asked me the other day, about taking anti-inflammatory, isn't that like putting a Band-Aid on it? And I was like, well, kind of everything is like putting a Band-Aid on it. Taking blood pressure pills, you're just putting a Band-Aid on it until you take your next pill. Orthopedics gives us the opportunity to really kind of fix something and address a problem. And sports medicine, you know, in particular, you know, everybody thinks, oh, I'm not an athlete. I'm 40 or I'm 50, or I'm 60. You know, you can't see me. That's not true. I mean, I think there's lots of people who have injuries, or not every injuries, but conditions that involve, you know, these joints, and you treat people the same way. Just because, you know, you're a high school doesn't mean you're treated any different than the college, or any different than the pro athlete, or any different than the weekend warrior, or 50, 60, 70 year old. And there are plenty of, you know, 70 year olds out there right now who tear ACLs and tear rotator cuffs and have issues, you know, that decreases their quality of life. Lots of people can live with stuff, but some people don't want to. And if they want to be active and they want to get it fixed, you know, it's very rewarding for us to be able to fix that person and you know, give them the opportunity to go back to you know, active, pain-free or minimal pain lifestyle.
Well, Dr. Flores, I want to thank you very much for your time.
And the surgery is really cool.
And surgery is really cool.
And the surgery is really cool.
Surgery is really cool. Always going to the operating room is cool.
Yes.
You know, Dr. Flores is with Dr. Lowe, the UT Department of Orthopedics, and they are officially partnered with our Master of Athletic Training program that you can access at www.hhp.uh.edu/MAT. Go into partnerships and look up the link to the UT Department of Orthopedics, and you'll be able to look up Dr. Flores. And he's also with the Ironman Sports Medicine Institute, which we've also been able to partner with. We're very, very fortunate with that. Dr. Flores, thank you very much for your time. If somebody's got questions for you, can they email you?
Or probably the easiest way is contacting my office.
And how do they contact your office?
It's probably on the website. It's probably the easiest way, yeah.
And so go through that link then. Yeah, just the way. All right. Dr. Flores, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it. I know you got to get back and see patients.
All right. Appreciate it.
Everybody's waiting for it. Thanks a lot. Bye.